The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
Now you've got an opportunity. If someone here did not look at the Ten Commandments, and you know the topic, right? What's the topic we're going to discuss today? One word? Lying, right? Falsehood, lying. So now you're God. I think that's very, you know, open of me. You are now God. And you've got to tell the Jewish people of the world, don't what? So how would you phrase it? Okay? Now we've got, remember, don't murder, lo tirtach. Don't adulter, lo tin'af. Don't steal, lo tignov. And now I can say, don't lie, lo tishaker. And that's what I expect to see. Which makes it, of course, all the more strange that that's not what I see. At all. And there's a whole discombobulated weird thing. What do I find? Look at the end of verse 13. Lo ta'aneh v'reacha eid shaker. Now what does that mean? Look in the English. Thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor. Now let's take a look at this for a moment. First of all, what are we talking about? What's the case? The case is a very specific case. This is what the Talmud tells me. And this is a case of perjury. And it's an instance where one individual, specifically two individuals, although that will be part of our question, come to testify falsely concerning a particular deed, action, event. And the Talmud gets very specific, as does the Torah in other places. And we call these witnesses Edim Zomamim. Now, Edim Zomamim, or as they're practically referred to in the Yeshiva world, Edim Zomamim, right, are false witnesses, or perjury witnesses. Really, the word lezomem, right, kasher zimem, lasot lachiv, means to plot. They're plotting witnesses, right? Two people come along, and they testify regarding an event. I don't know, God forbid somebody's killed. And they say, well, we saw, Julie and Aaron commit the murder. We saw them, they were there, we saw them plunge the knife in, they did it, right? Together, they both held the knife, right? Okay. And then come along, right, another pair of witnesses. Now, there are two possibilities, okay? Possibility number one is that a second set of witnesses, right? Abby and David, right? David, right? Okay, Abby and David, they come along and say, nope, sorry, but we know that Julie and Aaron didn't do it because we saw the whole thing happen and it wasn't Julie and Aaron. In other words, we saw that they didn't do it, right? So the first set of witnesses that testify that they did it are now considered perjured witnesses. That's one possibility. Everybody got that? Okay. Second possibility is that Abby and David come along and say, well, these two witnesses who are testifying that Julie and Aaron did it, I don't know, Ann and Jesse, right, they couldn't be telling the truth. Why? Because they were in Nepal with us during that whole month. Right? We were all off in Nepal, and they could not have possibly seen those. They're not testifying that they didn't do it. They have no idea if they did it. What they're testifying to is that the testimony can't be true, because they were with them, right? In other words, I have two pairs of witnesses. We'll call them Group A and Group B. Group A comes along and testifies to a murder. Group B comes along and can do one of two things. They can either say, no, the murder didn't occur in that fashion, or the money was never lent, or whatever the case may be. So now I have two conflicting sets of witnesses, all right? In that case, the court has no choice but to disrule the case, because they don't know who's telling the truth. But then I have a second possibility. Second possibility is a very specific case. And the second possibility is where Group A comes along and testifies to a particular activity, and Group B comes along and offers very specific testimony. Not invalidating the act or the possibility of that original crime or even the possibility that the perpetrators accused are in fact the perpetrators. What they invalidate is totally and only the testimony. And the way that they invalidate that testimony is also very specific. They invalidate the testimony based on the fact that Group A could not have testified to that act because they were in a different place, in a different city. Okay, you got it? Those are my two possibilities. And that's what it says we're talking about here. So don't get me wrong, that's a pretty negative thing to do. You know, and as a matter of fact, the punishment or consequence is very specific. The Torah says, what do you do to that Group A of witnesses? What do you do to them? I mean, if Group A comes along and testifies that these people killed someone, right? So essentially, the punishment in the Bible, at least, how you get to that is another story. But the punishment in the Bible for murder is death, capital punishment. So they're essentially trying legally to get them put to death. So what's the punishment? The punishment is that they themselves are put to death. But only in the second case. Only in an instance where their testimony is proved to be incorrect by virtue of the fact that they couldn't have been there. You punish them with exactly what they would have inflicted upon the supposed perpetrators. You got me so far. Now, there's sometime an instance, for example, where you can't punish them with what they plan to inflict. I'll give you an example. The Talmud says, for example, if there's an offense which will invalidate a priest from serving as a priest, right? So I can't punish them with that punishment unless they're priests. So in that particular event, there's a whole other system, flogging, whatever it is. But of course, I have a much bigger question. Why is this in the Ten Commandments? I mean, it should just say, don't lie. But what's this whole convoluted, complicated issue? And don't get me wrong here. Obviously, all of this has very much to do with lying. And if my original supposition, based on tradition, is that these Ten Commandments allude to the entire Torah, and therefore each commandment alludes to a whole host of different things, so obviously this would be the commandment that lying falls under and into. But lying would have been something that I expected to see quite specifically. So that's something we have to think about. Why not lying? Why false testimony? Go a stage further. Look at the verse, and you will see proof par excellence for the fact that a translation is never enough. It's important, it's valuable, you can learn a lot of Torah from a translation, but obviously we're missing something. How do I know we're missing something, right? Because the Hebrew here is lo ta'aneh v'reacha ed shakir. You shall not ta'aneh in your neighbor, let's say, your friend, your colleague, another person, false testimony. So how does the English translate the word ta'aneh? Bear. Can anybody show me why that's not really enough of a translation? Now notice I don't say it's inaccurate. It might be close to accuracy, but it's not enough. Look at the third commandment. What's the third commandment? Right? You shall not take, you shall not bear, really, the Lord of the name in vain. And we spoke about what that means. And what's the word used there? Lo tisa. So what does lo ta'aneh mean? So there are really two words that are related to the word ta'aneh. Very interesting. First is, and there are actually three. Two are well known. Right? If you come and ask me a question, what do? I respond. What does it mean to respond? La'anot, correct, right? La'anot, to answer, to respond. So, that's interesting. You shouldn't respond to your friend in falsehood. Essentially, the relationships that we have with our fellow human beings are a series of stimuli and responses. And everything we do is really a response to the world around us, to the people that we share our lives with. Your response should not be falsehood. And it's interesting that a response is much easier to perceive as something which is conditioned, right? Something which is almost automatic. You have to somehow root this out of you. There's something about falsehood and false testimony which can become so natural as to become a response. has to become an instinct. It's very easy to have falsehood and lying be a part of your system. So that's the first inclination of what we're talking about here. Second, very interesting. On Yom Kippur, let's see, this is a real hard trivia question, I will grant you. But on Yom Kippur, right, there's certain things that we don't do. What's the most obvious? What don't we do on Yom Kippur traditionally? Eat, drink, right? Anybody know there's others? Anybody know? We don't wash, rechitza, that's true, right? That's two. Eating and drinking is one. Washing. We don't wear leather, right? Nilata sandal, right? What else? Or leather shoes, pardon? Relations, sex, right? And what's the fifth? Oils, right? Body lotions and oils, whatever that means. And what's this oil based on, right? And this is part of the oral tradition, but there is a reflection. This is reflected, excuse me, in the written tradition. Ve'initem et nafshotechem, which we translate as meaning, you shall afflict your souls. In other words, there's some form of a measure of affliction that we inflict upon ourselves on Yom Kippur. Now, it's very different from the, let's say, I don't consider myself an expert on this topic, but at least from my perception of sometimes within Christianity, one can find classical Christianity, the concept of afflicting yourself to achieve something, and that's very different here. Here it's clear that the issue is not so much to afflict yourself as to remove from yourself, right, the obstacles, whatever they may be. And a very difficult idea. But the initen literally means to afflict, right? So now look at that in this verse. Lo ta'anev re'acha et shaker. Don't afflict your fellow human being with false testimony. Of all the things that you can do to another human being that we're listing here, murder, theft, adultery. Isn't it interesting that the one which is somehow alluded to as an affliction, as real punishment, as causing suffering, is falsehood? Very interesting. And then there's a third meaning of the word. And you know, the mystics believe that anytime a word has different meanings, each of those meanings relate. It's not as though I have synonyms and this meaning doesn't apply. They all apply. They all part in the same. Right? Especially if you consider the original perspective that this book is not written by man, but possibly divine, right? At least that's my perspective. So then, of course, all the different meanings of the word must play into it somehow. There's another meaning. And this is the one that fascinates me the most, because it's the most out of context, and it also happens to be the one that people usually miss, right? In the, I believe it's the 25th chapter of Deuteronomy, okay? There's a beautiful, beautiful custom. At certain periods of time, a certain time of the year, right before Shavuot, one of the holidays, you take the first fruits and you put them in a basket. It's a beautiful ceremony as described in the Mishnah. And you literally put the basket on your shoulder, and rich, poor, wealthy, indigent, doesn't matter. Everybody does the same. And you get off your donkey and you take some of the fruits out of your cart and you put them on your shoulder, on your basket, and you come to the house of God, to the temple, and you give these first fruits to the priest. And there's a whole ceremony. And part of the ceremony is ve'anita ve'amarta. And you shall answer and you shall say. Right? And it's very strange. What does it mean that you shall answer and you shall say? You answer and you respond to something that's been said to you. You're just opening a discussion here. So there are different opinions. And some rabbis say, well, you're saying something to God about the first fruit. And really you are responding. You're responding in recognition and in gratitude to what God has given you, to the first fruits. But there's another opinion. Magnificent opinion. And this opinion says that Anita means to sing. Matzah. Matzah is called lechem oni, which is generally taken to mean the bread of affliction. Right? Because it was the bread that we made when we were still in bondage, still in Egypt, before we left. There's a second opinion. Right? There's a beautiful debate. It's one of those debates that seems so ridiculous until you start to delve into it. How many matzahs do we have on Pesach? Right? We have everybody knows what a matzah is, right? Yes? Anybody? No? Unleavened bread? Okay. Right? So how many do I use? On Shabbat, how many chalot do I have? How many loaves? I have two. What about on Passover? I have three, right? There's an opinion of the Vilna Gaon, which is accepted by many, although, you know, not by everybody, that you actually have two. Very interesting. Maimonides says you have three. Vilna Gaon says you have two. Why? So the big opinion is that in the middle of the Seder, at a certain point, before you make the hamotzi, before you actually eat the bread, you break it in half, one of the matzot, you break it in half, and you hide half of it. That's the afikoman, that's what we all remember, because that's the fun part of the Seder, whatever it is, right? That's where we get the big bucks, the big prize, right? So it says, Maimonides, you have to have three, and he's not the only one, many others. What does Maimonides also say too? I don't remember. Maybe it's Nachmanides I'm thinking of. Whatever. Big debate, okay? Just reminds me that I have to go look it up again, right? So there are two, right? And I break one of them. So now when I get to the point where I'm eating the matzah, right, I've only got 1.5, and I need 2. Therefore, I have 3, so that even when I break 1.5, I still have 2 whole ones. Says the Vilna Gaon, no, you should really have 2 and break 1.5. Because what the matzah symbolizes is the fact that I remember being a slave, that I remember being afflicted, that I remember being a poor person. And what does a poor person do? A poor person never eats all his food at one shot, because he doesn't know where he's going to get his next meal from. He's always eating a little and saving a little. If you look at stories of the Holocaust, in the camps, they would take a part of their ration and they would hide them in their coat or in their pockets so that they'd have something. Right? And this was deemed to be smart because you didn't know where your next food was coming from. So says the Vilna Gaon, that's the whole point, that I shouldn't have 2 whole matzot, because that's a sign of wealth, and that's the opposite. Comes along Maimonides and says the opposite. Nope, the opposite. Because lechem oni doesn't mean the bread of affliction. It's lechem she'omim alav halel. It's the bread that you sing halel, praise over. Because this bread is a symbol of the fact that we got out of Egypt. So both of these possibilities for the word oni reflect a very important idea in Judaism. I'll give you an idea. I'll give you an example. On Rosh Hashanah, we have all sorts of different sounds that we blow with the shofar, right? Anybody here ever go to a Sephardic wedding, a Tamani, Yemenite wedding? You know what they do at a wedding? Unbelievable, right? Or you ever go to the Kotel, the wall here, and hear a Yemenite bar mitzvah? What do the women do, right? And men as well, right? Right? They all go nuts. I tried for years to do that just with my tongue. I don't have that kind of muscle control, right? But they don't, you know, they do it with their tongue, right? Right, and they're all like yelling, you know. I remember at my bar mitzvah when I was 13, so we actually pushed off the actual bar mitzvah day because I wanted to have my first aliyah at the wall, and you know, my parents were all for this, and since they were coming anyway in the summer, so I had my bar mitzvah in the summer at the Kotel, right down here. I had my bar mitzvah, right? It's kind of cool. And me and 14 million other people. And on that day, there was like there were however many other bar mitzvahs there were at the wall that particular morning, and there was a Sephardic bar mitzvah right near me. I remember my mother was a little annoyed because she was up on a bench. She was trying to see, you know, her son's bar mitzvah. And all these women are like edging out of the way to see their kids' bar mitzvah. Okay, fine. So it's all, you know, beautiful, love, brotherhood, humanity. We're all sharing the same experience and sweat and whatever else it is. Anyway, she said at one point, she sent a message over that we should wait a second because she couldn't hear. Why? Because there were like 1,900 women who were screaming, like, aah! And she didn't know what was going on, like an Indian ceremony or something, right? And she didn't understand. What's really fascinating, I remember the last day that I was in the army, the day that I was slated to finish, or I thought I was finished. Really, when you go to reserve duty, you're really beginning the army. But I thought I was done. And there's a whole thing, they have a whole ceremony, you know, you get like, whatever, sometimes you get a promotion, and you get you have a discussion with your battalion commander, and everybody says goodbye, and they throw you a party, and they make this horrible concoction of muck, and they throw whatever they can find into it, and it's supposed to be a big surprise, and they dump it over you, right? When you get, like, new rank and the day you leave the army. So I was, like, wary of this and knew. Anyway, I was supposed to go and sit with my battalion commander, and we were going to have, like, a final discussion. It's usually like this thing, you know, he tells you you did a job well done, whatever, and they'll miss you, and will you stay? And of course you won't, whatever, fine. And, no, they actually, there aren't enough officers in the Israeli army, so they have this whole system to try to get you to sign on for more. So what did they offer me? They told me that they would send me to this advanced artillery gunnery course for officers. I forget which fort. I think it was Fort Bragg in America. And it was like a 6-week course. And then I would get another 6 weeks of nofesh. And I was paid for by the army to spend like 4 weeks in Florida. Like I could just be 4 weeks in Florida. I'd go to America. You know, they'd send me for 3 months to America, whatever. Thinking like, you're talking to the wrong guy. I want to go to America for 3 months. I don't need the army to send me. But okay. Anyway, that night there was a terrible, terrible tragedy. One of the guys, I wasn't close with him, I knew him. One of the guys who was in one of the units that fixed the tanks, two guys were walking out to do guard duty, and one of them was kidding around, he was fooling around, and he didn't realize his gun was loaded, and his gun went off, and he killed his best friend. And it was horrible, and more than dealing with, you know, the person who was dead, the person who was alive, had just killed his best friend accidentally. So obviously they canceled my meeting with the battalion commander and the whole demeanor of the base. And so the day that I was supposed to be getting out of the army, I ended up going to a funeral. And it's interesting, that night, there's a Jewish halakha that says, you never leave a body unattended. A Jewish body, that the period of time mystically, Kabbalistically, when the soul and the body are somehow separating, because in Judaism we believe that the soul doesn't die. It goes on to whatever existence it goes on to. We call it Olam Haba, the next world, whatever. But it separates from the physical. It's not this instant of death. And therefore, from the time of death until the time of burial, you don't leave a body alone. It's also part of recognition, recognizing what God gave us, and that we're going to end up there. And traditionally, two people sit, two women for a woman, two men for a man, sit by the body and say Psalms or study Torah, and there are all sorts of discussions as to what you are allowed to and not allowed to do, and it's very important that you don't just talk nonsensical. Anyway, while this whole thing is going on, so I said, well, is anybody with the body? Because the body was out by the bunkers. They said, no, they can't move it because the military police have to come to investigate. So they just left the body out on this road on the way to the bunker within the base. Because you can't do that. So it happened that I was the only guy, however you define this, as religious, who defined himself as religious on the base at the time. And I couldn't find anybody to do it with me. Everybody was busy doing other things. So I finally grabbed one of the cooks. And we went out there and we took a Jeep and we sat there all night until the military police came. So that's how I spent my last night in the army. Now the next day, I called my folks. You know, they were visiting from the States because I was getting out of the army. And they'd also planned, you know, a whole whatever. And I said, listen, we have to cancel it all because I have to go to a funeral. So my mother said, you know what, I don't want you to go on your own. We want to come. I said, look, you know, to come to a funeral, whatever. No. And my mother's very, very, very Zionistic. And she really wanted to go and she wanted to be there, whatever. So fine. Biggest mistake I ever made, taking my parents to a funeral for a soldier who had fallen. Not a good idea. But it was a very, very Sephardic funeral. And they did the same thing. And the mother, you know, Ashkenazic and Sephardic funerals are very, very different. As a rule. Not always, I guess, but as a rule. And the Western tendency is always like to keep it in, to control. You know, I have to be strong. I have to, you know, kind of keep up a face or whatever it might be. The Sephardim, at least the ones that I've seen, are completely the opposite. And I happen to think that it's a lot more healthy. And they just let it all out. And this woman, the mother of the soldier, was just screaming, and she didn't want to let go, and it's my son, and how can you let go? And the other women who were walking behind, right, were doing the exact same thing. Now, I had never been to a Sephardic funeral before. It was so strange, because it's exactly what they do at a bar mitzvah. The line between pleasure and pain, between joy and sadness, is a very thin line. And it's true psychologically. Sometimes you can be so happy you can cry, and sometimes tragedy can hit you with such shock that you can just burst into laughter. And laughter and tears. And you can look at someone sometimes, laughing, crying, crying, laughing, and not know whether they're happy or sad. And the same is true at the Passover Seder. Because essentially there is tremendous sadness and tragedy. All that we've been through in Jewish history. And all that was given up in order to redeem the Jewish people. And Egyptians had to die in the Red Sea. Now it may be that God made that decision, but it doesn't mean it doesn't cause us pain. As a matter of fact, there's a custom when you hold up the cup of wine for the 10 plagues, you take your finger and you dip it into your cup of wine and you drop one drop of the wine out of the cup for each plague. It's such a strange custom. Well, the wine symbolizes our joy at redemption. And the drop you're dropping symbolizes remembering that someone, even if they deserved it, had to pay a price for that. Tremendous idea. So now get back to our commandment. So now look at this word. Lo ta'anev re'acha et shaken. You shouldn't afflict your fellow human being with false testimony. You shouldn't take pleasure and find joy in falsehood at the expense of your friend. Right? And those two are very much connected. So with that introduction, I want to understand, what is this? What is perjury? What is falsehood? Why is it in the Ten Commandments? Isn't it a given? Don't I naturally assume, right, that one shouldn't tell a lie? And how do I view this whole question? And I want to tell you that the most frightening thing, there's certain, I don't know, call them transgressions, we'll call them no-nos, right? There's certain big no-nos that are so much a part of our social framework, of our upbringing, that the contemplation of being involved in them, let alone committing them, is almost beyond us. Murder. I mean, nobody here contemplates, I hope, murder. Sometimes, you know, I don't know, someone does something, I'm going to kill him. But you don't really contemplate murder. And then there are things which are the opposite. That most people don't even contemplate not committing them. Like falsehood. And I'll give you the best example I can think of. There is a sound which to me always signifies the ease of lying. And that is the following sound. What does it sound like? What? A PA system, a radio squawk, right? That is known in the army, right? Okay? Sometimes you get an order. And you get an order over the radio, and you don't want to keep that order, right? I've seen sometimes in movies that police do this also. I don't know if it's true, but it's certainly true in the army, right? I don't know, you know, you have to report in every once in a while, right? And you always arrange it. You know, what's the first thing you look at? I don't know, you go to, you're an intifada duty. So you go to Ramallah or Hebron or Gaza, wherever it is, and you have a patrol route. So the first thing, you have to learn your patrol route very carefully, know where it is, where it isn't, know what the boundary is, know where your jurisdiction is, know where the hot spots are, you know, all these different things. What's the most important thing you have to learn on your patrol route the first day you get there? Pardon? Nope. Where are the pitots sold? Right? Where can you get a good cup of coffee? Very important. Very important. And I remember we were doing a patrol in near Kalkilia in Azun, and there was a place called Karnei Shomron, and they had a Jewish settlement, and they had like a, you know, like a steakia. Like, you know, they sold steaks and pitot and hamburgers, and it was great for me because it was like super duper kosher or whatever you want to call it, right? We'll get to that tomorrow. And so we sort of rearranged our whole patrol route system so that we would end up at particular times at this place so that we could, you know, spiritually satisfy ourselves, right? And, you know, every once in a while you get an order, oh, listen, we need you back on base because there's a question or there's a school bus that needs an escort or whatever it is. Or the battalion commander said, you know, you should kind of get back to base. He wants to talk to you about something, whatever it is. Not like, you know, God forbid there's a terrorist attack and, you know, urgent. But like, you know, it's going to be one of those things. So you're in the middle of a conversation. You say, listen, try to get back to base. Will you be back soon? And then all of a sudden the ear is like, you're breaking up. I'll try to get back to you. Out of radio contact, I'll try to get back to you when I'm over the hill, right? And this is like natural. And so natural that you can hear the other guy laughing when you do it. But you have to understand that every communique goes into the log. So you know, you got to enter the log, right? Well, you're lying. You're lying. You're allowed to do that. How far does lying go? Have we ever spent a day? I'll give you an extreme example. Rav Amital, the Rosh Yeshiva in Gush. So every once in a while he would make these, you know, sort of get-togethers with alumni to keep a relationship, you know, whatever. And I would always go whenever I could because he's a very, very special human being. And someone once raised their hand and said, you know, well, when one chooses one's profession, right, how much does halakha play a role in that? And are there certain professions that one can't do? And he got into a whole discussion on this topic. And no one take offense at this because this was in a wider context. But somebody said, well, you know, what's wrong with being a lawyer? I mean, there are a lot of lawyers. So Rav Amital said, look, it's not a question of there being anything wrong with being a lawyer. It's that every profession has their challenges. He says, but I'll give you an example. He says, how many lawyers are there in the room? And there were like 80 of us there. But like, I don't know, 9, 10 guys raised their hand somewhat slowly, right? You know, because they know Rav Amital. He says, okay, I just want to ask a question to all the lawyers in the room. Can you honestly say within the last year that you've never had to lie? Total silence. Very difficult. So, you know, those of us who aren't lawyers, we sit here smugly like, well, I'm not a lawyer, right? What about when you say something like, I've told you 1,000 times? Well, have you really told them 1,000 times? No. So you're lying. Or are you lying? How far does lying go? You know, sometimes, one of, I think, the dangers in what we might call, this is very difficult to define, the Baal Tshuva movement, right? A whole movement among a certain branch of society, groups of people who rediscover Judaism, although I'm willing to bet that this is true for any religion, that there's a Baal Tshuva Christian movement and a Baal Tshuva Muslim movement and a Baal... But Baal Tshuva means someone who has taken upon themselves repentance, whatever. And within this movement, this framework, right, the Baalei Tshuva, so sometimes a person can tend to become very dogmatic very quickly. Very easy, right? Because going from A to Z is just easier. I don't have to deal with what and what not and what order and what stage and what perception. I just take it and I do it all. Which is, if you've heard me say before, I think is a very, very dangerous and a very unhealthy thing to do. Because it's not real. And what's outside has to match what's inside, right? So let's say someone comes at it and says, okay, I'm never going to lie. Lying is just terrible, right? And this person becomes very concerned sometimes, not just whether they're lying, but whether anybody else around them is lying, right? And this can take on sometimes extreme proportions. And this may not be a legal term, but it can drive you nuts. So how far do you go with this? How far do you go with this? Right? Somebody comes over to you and says, you know, I just got this new sweater. What do you think? And you say, I cannot tell a lie. That's the most horrid thing I've ever seen. Well, you're not lying. That's good. Right? You can imagine the dinner conversation that would occur if the chicken gets burned. So how far do you go? And by the way, it's very interesting, because there are a number of places, one specifically, where the Torah takes the time to specifically prohibit lying. And where is that? So if you look in Exodus chapter 23, verse 7, this is an unbelievable verse. So what does it say here? Verse 7. It doesn't say, don't lie. It says, midvar sheker tirchak, top of the page. Distance yourself from lying. Right? Keep far from falsehood. And it's interesting that the second half of the phrase refers to something else. In Akiv, it's tzaddik al tarog. Don't kill someone who's clean. But the rabbis say, vinaki can also refer to the previous sentence, midvar sheker tirchak vinaki. Keep yourself distance from a lie and be clean. In other words, you gotta keep yourself clean. How do I do that? And it almost seems to be that falsehood is this super duper negative, and that I constantly have to be concerned with avoiding falsehood. But of course, that's not true either. In Ethics of the Fathers, and I meant to look up the specific Mishnah, I believe it might be in the 6th chapter, but I don't remember, but I will look it up and find that I just didn't have time this morning. So I don't remember which Mishnah it is. But in Ethics of the Fathers, it's very interesting. It speaks about being hevei mital midav shel Aaron. A person should strive to be of the students of Aaron. Why? What was Aaron? Ohev shalom v'rodev shalom. He was a lover of peace and a pursuer of peace. And the Mishnah goes on to say, what does it mean, and the Medrash discusses this also, what does it mean that he was not just a lover of peace, but a pursuer of peace? It says he did an unbelievable thing. Unbelievable thing. When two people would be arguing, right? When two people would be having a dispute, so he would go over to one, you know, and, I don't know, you know, a husband and a wife were having a terrible argument, right? Pay me $1 million. One thing I would never try to do is get between husband and wife. But Aaron was gifted. And he would go over to the husband and he would say, listen, you know, your wife, she was in to see me. I was in the vegetable store and we started talking and she really wants to make up with you. She feels so bad about what she did, but she's too embarrassed to say it. And then he'd go over to the wife and he'd say to her, you know, we were learning together and he was saying how terrible he feels and how embarrassed he is and he's just too embarrassed to say it, but he really wants to make up with you. And then they'd go together and they'd just find a way to make up and it'd be all great and hunky and you could make a movie, right? Except for one little thing, Aaron was lying. So I guess, in the interest of peace, you can lie. Well, that's a very dangerous thing. I mean, we like to think of things as objectively wrong. If lying is wrong, then it's just wrong. And the Bible goes so far as to say I have to distance myself from lying. And yet, here's an instance where not only is lying, at least it seems, I mean, Ethics of the Fathers is not a halachic work, but certainly tradition, the rabbis, anywhere you look, seems to espouse this view, where lying seems to be not only permissible, but desirable. So maybe I'm wrong. Maybe every time I see somebody who's ugly, I should actually specifically tell them how beautiful they are. And this is, by the way, a famous debate between the House of Hillel and the House of Shammai. The House of Hillel would always say that no matter what, you should always tell the bride that she's beautiful. And the House of Shammai, absolute truth, would say no. If the bride isn't beautiful, don't tell her she's beautiful. Now, I don't know if the House of Shammai went out of their way to tell the bride she's ugly. But if somebody would ask you, you couldn't lie. I cannot tell a lie, you are ugly. I mean, is that really what we want? And this becomes a very difficult problem sometimes. For example, there's a prohibition of slander, right? Lashon hara, evil tidings, whatever, evil tongue. So there are different factors within this prohibition. One of them is called rechilut, gossip. Now, if I say that so-and-so, right, is a thief, and they're not, so that's obviously forbidden. If I say that so-and-so is a thief, and they are, that's also forbidden. But if I say, you know, Brian has nice glasses, right? So, what's wrong with that? I mean, he has nice glasses. I just said he has nice glasses. I complimented his glasses. I don't know, maybe he takes it personally, and now he has new, renewed self-esteem and confidence by virtue of the fact that I've complimented his glasses. So what's wrong with that? So the rabbi's going to a whole discussion about gossip. Because if you sit around and say, yeah, Brian has nice glasses, so what will someone else say, possibly? What's that magic word? Oh, yeah, but his glasses are nice, but did you see his face? You know, I mean, if people, I mean, there's just no, right? So you can't gossip. There's meaningless conversation. Conversation has to have meaning, it has to have purpose. No, you don't just sit around and talk about whatever. Fine. So what if somebody says, what if I'm having a deep discussion with Brian about, I don't know, Julie? And Julie comes over to me, and she sees that I'm talking with Brian, and she knows that Brian and her are having this whole issue, whatever it is. Right? So Julie comes over to me and says, well, what did Brian say about me? Now let's say Brian had all these terrible things to say. So now I've got a real dilemma. If I tell the truth, well, that's horrible. I can't tell the truth. So I'm going to have to lie. So then you say, no, just don't say anything. I really rather not talk about it. Well, that's a lot worse also. Oh, really? So what do you do? How do I find this middle line? So what I really have to try to do is understand what lying is about. What is falsehood about? Why is it in the Ten Commandments? And why does it begin with perjury? So there are a couple of issues that we have to get to in order to understand this. Okay? And I'd like to, by the way, I'd like to get also to the stage where we can even come up with a practical side. To, you know, as we did yesterday, as much as is possible within this framework, to come up with a practical perception on what one can do. And by the way, you know, it's interesting, when you talk about adultery, so beyond the philosophical and the, you know, the implication of what adultery really means and what we understand, how it applies to each one of us, everybody's sitting in class and having that sort of thought in the back of their mind, yeah, but I don't really adulter. In other words, like, you know, okay, so if adultery is related to idolatry, and if you can cheat yourself, you can adulter on yourself, and all that may be true. But in the back of your mind, you're still saying, okay, but the big one, I'm not worried about. And even when it comes to theft, and it'd be very hard not to steal ever, when you think about it, and you really get down to it. But still, in the back of your mind, you sort of say, yeah, but I'm not a thief. Like, okay, maybe I mess up, you know, but I'm not a thief, right? If I go into the dining room and I take a second helping, and maybe there's someone who didn't get it, so I'm a thief, but I'm not a thief, right? When it comes to this one, so that's a little more difficult. Because can anybody really say that they don't lie, that they never lie? In fact, I want you to know, there's a whole system in the ethical system that believes in I don't know, delineation, lists. You want to improve the value of your Torah study, keep track of how much study you really do. And I remember when I was in yeshiva, and I was going to this early Vatikin minyan, this prayer group that got together to pray before sunrise. So in the winter, it's not such a weird hour, but in the summer, sunrise is like at 4 in the morning. So you get up to pray at like 3:15, and it's beautiful, and they have this balcony that they prayed on overlooking the sunrise. Magnificent. And I did this for 2 years until I just couldn't do it anymore. And then, you know, you're getting up at 3 in the morning, and you're learning until 11 o'clock at night or 12 o'clock at night. You think you're learning like 20 hours a day. And someone once said to me, you know, you should really keep track of what you're learning and what you do, because then you can focus on it. So I started doing this, and I realized I was studying like 8 hours a day. Half of my time was just wasted. So the same is true with anything. If you want to work on something, so often all you have to do is just take note first of what you're doing. So at one point I decided, okay, this is the mitzvah of the month, you know, I'm going to work on lying. So I figured every day I would keep track. If I felt that I had lied, I would keep a notebook and I would just write it down. And I figured, you know, I got this little notebook, you know, one of these little like these guys, right? These little like, you know, only 20 pages, whatever it is, notebook, right? And I figured like, you know, I'll spend a couple of pages on lying and I'll work on it and then I'll do another one, whatever. Anyway, I remember the first night I sat down, like I decided that every time I had done something and I thought it might be construed as a lie, that I would write it down. Anyway, by the middle of the first week, I'd filled up the notebook. There was just no room. Because it's amazing how many things you do in your day that you could construe as a lie without even realizing it. So So here we really have to see if we can come up with some sort of a perception, some practical idea that can help us to think about it. Okay. So let's go back to Persia. What is testimony? And why is testimony the system that the Torah uses to introduce me to the problem of lies? So in order to understand this, I want to get back to the very specific case, because there's one interesting dilemma that I have. Just to remind you again, comes along Group A, and Group A, again, says that person X has, let's say, murdered. Comes along Group B and says, no, person X really couldn't have been the murderer because Group A was with us. They were in Hawaii. Right? Hawaii is better than Nepal. Okay, right? So now it gets very interesting. Because what do? I essentially believe Group B, and I take their word at face value instead of Group A. Now, there's a very deep problem here. If I was merely saying that because Group B, right, the second witnesses come along and contradict Group A, that therefore I can't convict based on A's testimony, that would make sense to me. Because I've got two people who say she did it, and two people who say she couldn't have done it because they were with us. So I can't possibly convict someone if I've got conflicting testimony, so that should be it. But that's not what I do. See, I believe Group B over Group A. You understand this? And I take the word of the second witnesses against the word of the first witnesses and assume that the second witnesses are right. Why? Maybe the first witnesses are right. Maybe the second witnesses are lying. Maybe they have some interest that I don't know about. There are a number of issues here that are very, very important. The Ramban, and the Sefer HaChinuch discusses this. Nachmanides offers a very interesting perception as to why I believe the second group of witnesses. It's very interesting. I don't begin from the assumption that someone is not good. I begin with the assumption someone is good. I begin with the assumption someone's telling the truth. I begin with the assumption that there's no reason for someone not to tell the truth. And the only thing that prevents me from believing that someone is telling the truth is something which attacks that assumption. And that's called a reyuta, almost an eviling, right? Something which fundamentally undermines the assumption. And it's only if that assumption is fundamentally undermined that I don't believe the assumption. And we find this in halacha in general. I'll give you an example. So there's a tradition that a woman in certain instances goes to mikvah. And there's a tradition that a man in certain instances goes to mikvah, right? To a ritual bath, we'll call it, right? And that ritual bath has to be a certain size. It has to have a certain amount of water in it. And if it's missing that amount of water by even a cupful, then the whole mikveh is invalidated. Now, if you want to understand mikveh and why that is and what it means and what that volume represents symbolically and mystically, so Rabbi Arya Kaplan has a beautiful, beautiful article on mikveh. It's called The Waters of Eden. It's magnificent. I urge you to read it. But let's say that I now want to go to mikveh. I don't know. It's the time of the temple. I want to offer a sacrifice. I have to go to mikveh. I have to go to this ritual bath. So don't I have to measure the bath? I mean, I should have to measure it. If I know that in order for the bath to be good, it has to be a certain size, I should have to measure it. No, I don't have to measure it, because I can assume that it's good. Now, let's say after I've been in the bath, someone comes along, and he's like super firm. He's like, Mr., you know, I want to be ultra religious. So he decides he wants to measure the bath. There's no prohibition against measuring the bath, right? Although sometimes there is, but that's an interesting question. There's no prohibition against measuring the bath, right? So he measures the bath. He finds that it's missing a cupful. So now the bath is no good. He can't immerse himself. What about me? I already immersed myself. So shouldn't I have to immerse myself again? So the halacha is clearly, no, I don't. Because there was nothing to undermine that assumption when I went in. So now that assumption is undermined. Now I know that it's impure, but I have no way of knowing that it was impure when I went in because I didn't measure before I went in. I can assume the bath. And we find this in various instances in halacha. The concept of edut, of testimony, is an assumption of the good in human beings. It's a basic assumption that human beings are capable of good. And that deep within them, they are essentially good and essentially honest. And it's interesting, by the way, testimony need not be two people. in a capital case and in monetary cases, we establish testimony based on two witnesses, right? In other words, if we're going to convict someone of murder, there must be two witnesses. And there's a rigorous system of interrogation. Those two witnesses are separated, and the court sits with them, three judges, right? There's no lawyers, no defending lawyer, no prosecuting lawyer to sort of attempt to present truth in a favorable manner. Truth is supposed to be truth. And it's the judges themselves who interrogate the witnesses, and they do it separately. And the whole idea is that if their stories can perfectly match, then the assumption of truth stands up, right? What is that assumption of truth for two witnesses? It's based on the fact that if two human beings can see something and can agree on it and are so in sync, it represents the harmony that two human beings are capable of amongst each other. That's the underlying idea of testimony. If two witnesses come along and they testify to something, and then another group comes along and testifies that those first witnesses couldn't be telling the truth because they were with us, then what I've done is I've undermined the assumption regarding those two witnesses. I've undermined the assumption that they're telling the truth and that they're good. Because if their assumption of good is based on the fact that there's an underlying harmony between human beings, well, here are two people who attempted to get somebody put to death. So that belies that very same harmony on which the testimony is based. So now their testimony is no longer good. And there's an assumption that their testimony is undermined, but no one's come along to undermine the second group of testimony. In other words, if the first witnesses would come along and say something else and undermine the second witnesses, then that'd be interesting. But the first group of witnesses now cannot testify. They don't have the capability to testify because their testimony has been undermined. And therefore, nothing they say can be acceptable because they don't have the ability to testify. And even their attempt to undermine the second group wouldn't be good because the only way they could undermine the second group's testimony is by their own testimony, which is already undermined. So therefore, says the Rambam, logically, I accept the second group because their testimony still is based on an assumption of good. And the first group can't be. There is an additional point that I have to make here, but before I make that point, I want to make just one additional point. You know, testimony need not be based on two, it can be based on one. There are very many cases in which I accept the testimony of one person. For example, we have a concept known as Eid Echad Ne'eman Be'isurin. One witness is believed, is considered a valid witness when it comes to prohibition. For example, Bezrat Hashem this Shabbat, you can all come to Efrat, and you'll end up eating in my home. Who tells you my home is kosher? How do you know my home is kosher? If you go to Singapore, you want to go eat in a restaurant. If you choose to accept some of the traditions regarding kashrut, you have to check, is it kosher or not, right? And if I go into a restaurant, that's what I do. I check, I see, you know, is there a rabbinic license, is it kosher? How come you don't have to do that in my house? Same thing. Because I testify to the kashrut of my house. And if you don't know a person, you're not sure, and you ask a person, is it kosher? And that person says his house is kosher. Then there's an assumption that a person is good, and that a person is truthful, and that therefore the house is kosher, unless there's something to undermine that assumption. So for example, the person, let's say, doesn't celebrate Shabbat. So then it's understandable that there's a part of that system which includes kashrut that he doesn't accept. There's something therefore which undermines that assumption that his house is kosher, and then there's a question you can ask him, you can eat, can you eat, can you not eat, do you trust him, etc. Right? The same way that I have a problem accepting the kashrut of someone who desecrates Shabbat, unless they tell me and I believe that they're kosher, if someone's a liar, if someone's a thief, if someone's a murderer, there's a basic undermining of the assumption of kashrut, and unless I have something else to corroborate or force me to once again assume kashrut, then I don't accept the kashrut. But isn't this interesting? The concept of Eid Echad Ne'eman Be'isurin, of accepting the testimony of one, has the same underlying theme. See, people make a big mistake. And there are whole systems within, call it ultra-Orthodox, call it religious Jewry, that's a term subject to much discussion, that say, you know, I remember Lubavitch. So I have cousins who are Lubavitch. And I had tremendous, tremendous respect for Lubavitch Rebbe. And God should create more people who are on his level and who could spread love of fellow human beings and fellow Jews such as the Lubavitcher Rebbe. But there was one thing I never understood, and I don't say it's wrong or right because I never understood it. But Lubavitch decided at a certain point that, you know, if you're Lubavitch, you should only eat in another, either originally it was Lubavitch, and then eventually only eat in your own home. Because if you eat in somebody else's house, there's a risk. You'll eat, you'll eat something unkosher. And in order not to risk embarrassing someone else, and to eat in this person's home, and not to eat in that person's home, there was a general assumption you didn't eat in other people's home, at least meat. That's what he's talking about. Not generally eating, but not to eat meat. So when they would come to visit on the occasions that we got together, so they would eat fish, or they would eat whatever, they didn't eat meat. Now, I obviously have a lot of respect for this. I didn't have a problem with it. And I didn't even put the question that I'm about to put to you to them, because I didn't feel comfortable they'd be able to answer it, and I didn't want to put them on the spot. But there's a basic problem. The halacha of eight echad neman bisurim, of one witness being able to testify with regard to prohibition, is designed not to split people up, not to put people apart, but bring people together. In fact, the whole concept of you being able to meet in my house just based on the fact that I tell you it's kosher is designed to allow for us to eat in each other's house. And if part of the idea of kashrut causes us not to eat in each other's houses, at least the Jews, then we're missing the whole point. And this tells me that part of the underlying theme of kashrut, and especially of testimony, is harmony, is bringing us together. Maybe that's part of why this is all contained in the Ten Commandments. There is something about lying which does the exact opposite, which undermines the fabric of society, which causes not harmony but discord, which tends not to bring people together but to put them apart. And I told you that I have one more additional thing. And this is very interesting. What allows a judge? Think about it for a minute. Suppose you're a judge, and you convict somebody based on false testimony, right? In Judaism, you could never convict somebody alone. Any court has to have a minimum of three judges. The assumption that one person can be objective, at least in Judaism, I'm not speaking about other systems, doesn't work. And therefore, there's an assumption that no one person should make such decisions on their own. So therefore, you need three judges together to convict. Okay. In a murder case, you need at least 21. You can't convict a person of murder with less than 21 judges. And it's very interesting that the majority of the judges have to convict. And if all the judges convict, then the person goes free. It's very interesting. Right? Because if everyone thinks the person is guilty, then there's a risk that the only reason everybody thinks he's guilty is because no proper time was given to the other possibility. As a matter of fact, there's a whole halakhic question. If I'm the 21st judge, right, we're going around the room, and we're deciding, is the person guilty or not guilty? And let's say I think this person's really guilty. He's a murderer. But I know that if I vote guilty, he's going to go free. So what do? I say he's innocent so that he can be guilty. There's a specific section devoted to this question in the laws of judges that says that such a person is guilty of murder, guilty of murder, and a heinous crime, and is no longer valid as a judge, and any future court that he sits on, right, he's doing the same thing, and he's guilty of whatever crime's being, a very severe, severe discussion. That even in that instance, to put a convicted murderer away, you can't lie. Fascinating idea. Now, this, I hope, by the way, should raise some very interesting questions to you, but put them aside. Very interesting question. A judge or judges convict a person, and subsequently we find out that the testimony was false. And let's say, God forbid, to the best of my knowledge, has never happened in Jewish history, but let's say, because how you put a person to death in a Jewish court is almost impossible, but let's say two witnesses come to court, right? And based on their testimony, we convict somebody of murder, and as a court, we put him to death. And then we find out, two witnesses come back from the Far East, and they say, oh, well, that couldn't have been because those guys were with us. How do you deal with it? How do you live with this? How do you go on being a judge? So there's a beautiful idea in tradition, but I think it bespeaks a very important fundamental principle that relates to our issue. See, if everything is the court of man, if the earthly court is all there is, then you're right. And you've made a tragic mistake. In fact, how you could ever convict someone is an interesting question because it's just you. So say the rabbis, the Talmud discusses this very interesting thing. See, there's a second court. There's a Kabbalistic idea that any time a court sits on earth, the heavenly court sits as well. And the heavenly court comes to its conclusion. And the earthly court comes to its conclusion. And there's a very strange discussion. I believe it's in Avodah Zarah, but I might be wrong. It says that the heavenly court decrees and the earthly court carries it out. What does that mean? What do you mean? We're sitting down, we're making a decision. If you put someone to death, if there really is a system, and if that system is divine, and if the reason that I, as a court, am allowed to put someone to death halakhically is because God, all-perfect God, gives me the power to appoint judges, to have a court, and that court then has the possibility to put someone to death, then ultimately it's the system that comes from God that puts that person to death. And if the system that comes from God puts that person to death, that person must be worthy of death. There must be some reason that I don't know about, which allows that person to be put to death. Now that's very heavy stuff. I mean, to assume that any time a person dies, even if they're innocent, means that they're worthy of death. So it's interesting the Talmud stops short of allowing a person to consider why. It merely says that if a person dies, there must be a reason. We don't understand it. We don't know what it is. It's not only not our responsibility to try to analyze it, but in very specific instances, this is next month's course, but in very specific instances, it's almost a prohibition for us to try to figure it out, because we will inevitably be wrong. But it's the idea that there is some system of justice beyond what we understand that allows us to go on. That's very important. The system of law, for example, with murder, is so severe that it's just about impossible to put a person to death in the Jewish court of law. This is a mistake people make. People think, oh, Jews, no, they're cruel, capital punishment. It's not so true. In order to put someone to death for murder, first of all, you have to have two people, two witnesses, not just one, but two witnesses who see that person commit the murder. Circumstantial evidence is not admissible in Jewish court. It's given as a part of a question by those witnesses, but you can't convict based on circumstantial evidence. The Talmud goes so far as to say that if you see someone running after someone with a knife, and they run behind the wall, and a second later, one of them doesn't come out, and the other one comes out with a knife dripping in blood, and you walk around behind the wall, and you see that person dead, and you establish that if that knife had killed him, and there's no one else there, you still can't put a person to death, because you didn't see it. If that person himself says, I committed the murder, you can't put him to death. Ein adam mishim atzmo rasha. You're not allowed to convict yourself, because you are not objective about yourself. Talmud says, if a court put a person to death for murder once in 70 years, they were considered a cruel court. Now you may ask, wait a second. If I've got this whole system of punishment, and I can't use it, what's the point? Isn't it? It doesn't make sense. So it's interesting that in Judaism, the system of punishment for capital murder is not considered the actual deterrent. It's an educational idea. Now, there was a system for putting someone to death when the courts couldn't do it, and that was the king, the melech. The king could put someone to death without a court. And that was for various reasons, because that was the role of the king, and how the king did this, and whether the king could do this, and when it happened, and how it worked, was an interesting question. So that's an important underlying idea in understanding the concept of justice. That justice, human justice alone, cannot work without divine justice. So, let's take a totally different tack. We want to get back to what lying is and how lying is. But just as we discussed yesterday, I'd like to discuss with you the implication and the application. And see if we can put both into perspective. First of all, what is lying? Now, to give you a specific example of what lying is and what lying isn't is not so easy. But the Chazon Ish, right, Rav Yishayahu Karelitz, who was one of the great authorities in the last generation, Rav Yishayahu Karelitz says a tremendous thing. He says, what is lying? Lying is saying anything which is untrue, okay, whether it hurts someone or not, unless you are halachically allowed to do so. Stating anything which is not fact, whether it hurts someone or not, is considered a lie, unless there's a halachic permissibility to do it. So first of all, we have to give some examples of what it is to state someone without fact. And then we have to give some examples of whether there might be instances when it's permissible to do this. So, let me give you some examples. And I have to tell you that in the interest of not violating, yesterday's commandment, so I mentioned to you, it's very important to, you know, to make sure that if you quote someone, you're not stealing an idea. It's kind of silly to discuss lying and in the process violate stealing. But there's a magnificent book It's just a beautiful book. And sometimes books are magnificent because they're so complex, you just have to think on each line. Sometimes books are magnificent because they seem so simple, but then you sit back and think about the 40 pages you read in 10 minutes, and you think, ah, this is such a book. There's a book written by Rabbi Zelig Plissken, who you can actually go here on Wednesday nights, I forget exactly where. He doesn't discuss these topics, he has some kind of a whatever, you'd have to read about it to be able to understand what it is. But he writes a number of books. I believe one of them is here in our bookshelf. It's called, if I'm not mistaken, Love Thy Neighbor, and he goes through the portions of the week. And I took a look at what he had to say on lying, and he has some great examples. Okay? So, very interesting, right? He says, like this, okay? The severest form of lying, this is according to the Shari Tshuva, the severest form of lying is to cheat someone financially. Because if I'm lying to gain financial gain for myself, and at the expense of someone else's financial gain, that's a very severe form of lying. That's what he says, right? And this has very far-reaching implications. It goes without saying, for example, that that if you ask me if I owe you money and I do and I say no, then I'm lying. But how difficult is it in any financial undertaking to avoid lying? For example, if you're a storekeeper, can you say that you bought something for more than you actually bought it, knowing that this will influence someone else's decision to buy a product? In other words, if I'm selling a car, a used car, and I'm selling it for $10,000, and that's what I'm selling it for, can I say I bought it for $8,000 if I really bought it for $6,000? In other words, really, it shouldn't make a difference. You're looking at the car, and that's what I'm telling you I'm selling it for. It doesn't matter how much I bought it for. So halakhically, I'm not allowed to say I bought it for more than I bought it. I could just say I'm selling it for $10,000, because that's lying. It's not absolute truth. Right? Can I make up a story for social reasons? You know, you're sitting on a table, no one's anything to say, and I think of a good story. Story never happens. Now, it's not hurting anybody. It's just a funny anecdote. So if you start off saying, well, I'll tell you a story that never really happened. So nobody's going to listen to you. It sounds like really silly. So you say, well, there was a guy, whatever, whatever, and everybody's like, whoa, interesting story. So who cares? I mean, you're not telling a name, you're not hurting anybody, right? Can't do it. Why? And when you go down this list, you begin to sort of sense a question. Well, wait a second. What's the underlying idea here? What's wrong with this? Right? Embellishing a story. I'm telling a true story. You know? How often do we do that? To embellish a story. Power of a story. A student came into my office yesterday. We were talking. Wonderful girl. And she was saying, I taught her when I was in Pittsburgh for a year. And we were talking about it. And, you know, and this is, I think, par for the course. You know, she didn't remember much of what I had taught her, right? She remembered she enjoyed it, but she didn't remember Baruch Hashem, right? But she remembered a story that I told her. How did she remember the story? Because she thought it was such a great story. It's not my story, but it's a Rav Kalbach story. But she remembered the story. It was such a great story. And, you know, whenever she went somewhere, she would say, well, I had a teacher, and this teacher told me the story, whatever. And she was here in Israel, and she was at Hebrew University, and actually Rabbi Schoenbach, Danny Schoenbach, was giving her some classes. And he started telling the story. And he's like, wow, I know that story, right? Except that he told a totally different story. Now, he and I tell the story the exact same way, because we both heard it from Rosh Kaaba. So in the course of telling the story, the natural state of affairs is that the story changes a little. Also, it wasn't a train. It was a car. And, you know, he didn't fall. He was pushed. You know, whatever it might be. Can't embellish. Embellishment is the root of lying, right? It's asur. It's prohibited to tell somebody that you spoke well of them if you didn't. Let's say you know that somebody wants a job. They want a job. And you say, listen, let me see what I can do. And then this person ends up getting the job. Suppose you had nothing to do with it. Suppose this other person saw the name on a letter and decided that it was a good idea and followed up on it. This person would be ingratiated to you even though you didn't do anything. That's a lie. Because it's not absolute truth. You don't ever, it's not permissible to do it. Okay. How far does this go? Right? And it's interesting. I mean, if I promise somebody a favor, when you go to a wedding, so you're going to give a present, right? Let's say you go, you forget the present, or you forget to buy one, or you don't have money to buy one. So you say, listen, I really feel terrible, we wanted to bring you a present, but we're going to get it to you. If you aren't, in your mind, 100% convinced, you may not succeed, but if you're not 100% convinced that you're going to bring them that present, right? So, you're lying. It's not true. How far does this go? And it's interesting that the underlying question of lying becomes, not just are you lying, but how scrupulous are you in avoiding falsehood? And this is very interesting. And I think that there are two underlying ideas here. The first is, have you noticed something about every example that I gave you? And they were quite random. Have you noticed anything interesting in terms of what it is you're really doing? When you think about it, you're never really just lying. Think about it. Every example that I gave you is not just lying, it's also theft. Right? Stealing a person's emotions, stealing a person's time, stealing a person's money. In fact, if you think about it, can you ever really be just lying? Go a stage further. Have you ever met an honest thief? Can you be a thief and be completely honest? Think about it. Is it possible? Now, I'm not saying relative. I'm not saying that there are cruel thieves and kind thieves. But honestly, interesting idea. Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, in his commentary on Proverbs on Mishlei, says an unbelievable thing. He says, if you will resolve never to lie, you will end up leading a virtuous life. That's what he says. Why? Because if before you're about to do anything, you have decided, you know what, I can't handle all of these prohibitions, all of Judaism and everything, it's too much. But I'm not going to lie. I'm going to work on not lying. So if you decide before you do anything, am I going to have to lie? Well, it'll be very, very difficult for you to do anything wrong. If you want to steal something, well, the natural process of committing any form of felonious act is allowing yourself an escape hatch. What happens if I get caught? What happens if people ask me? If you ask yourself that question, and you've decided you're not going to lie, well, then it becomes more difficult to lie. It becomes more difficult to steal. If you're in a hotel room and you want to take a towel, if you ask yourself, what happens if somebody sees this towel in my house? Will I be able to say, oh, no, I stole that? If you say, well, I'm not going to be able to say that, then that means you're going to have to lie. And if you've already decided you're not going to lie, you won't be able to steal the towel. If you ask yourself any question related to that category, very interesting idea, right? By the way, there's a flip side to this. When I was a kid, my dad told me that there's four words you should ask yourself. Well, maybe it was my mom. Four words you should ask yourself before you do anything. Is it worth it? Is it worth it? You want to take a towel in a hotel. Is it really worth it? Do you really need a towel? What are you going to say? How embarrassed are you going to be if somebody sees the towel, right? So you don't take the towel. It's not worth it. Right? You're about to embarrass somebody. Is it worth it? Same is true with lying. Is it really worth it? Why am I lying? What's the value of my lying? Well, let's say I'm lying to embellish a story. Is it so important? Is it really worth it? So they don't have such a good story. Is it worth lying to tell a good story? No. Suppose I'm lying and I'm not hurting anybody. Right? Suppose I'm lying and I'm not hurting anybody. I tell you a great story about a Hasidic Rebbe that never existed. Right? How could it possibly hurt anybody? What's wrong with that? Well, it hurts one person. That's me. Because I'm lying to me. And every time you lie, it becomes easier to lie. It's hard to lie the first time you lie. You know, it's very interesting. I forget that. I think it was the Pele Yoetz, but it's quoted in Rabbi Pliskin's book. He says, you should always make it a practice, right, of saying, I don't know. I happen to think this is a very healthy thing to do, but I saw it this morning in his book. I think it's a brilliant point. Because if you get used to saying, I don't know, what's the problem? If it's hard for you to say, I don't know, it'll become very easy for you to lie. It will allow you to lie. Because if somebody asks you something and you don't know the answer, how many different circles will you make in order to avoid telling them, I don't know? But if you're used to saying, I don't know, it just becomes easy to say, I don't know. How do you teach your children not to lie? Very interesting. There are a lot of different things written on this. Well, first of all, and I do this with my children, if my children fess up to something that they did, if they did something really wrong, but they tell me they did something wrong, or I catch them and I see they're doing something wrong and I say, how could you do that? Then I will always forgive them. Always. I mean, whatever discussion we have, always. If my child lies and says, I didn't do it, or whatever, right? Then I'm always going to be more strict. I'm going to have a longer discussion with them, and I don't really have other forms of punishment. Sometimes they'll go to bed, you know, whatever it might be if I think it's appropriate. Because I'm teaching them that lying doesn't pay. But it's even more interesting than that. And I saw this in somebody else's home. It didn't hit me until I saw this, right? This kid was pestering his parents. He wanted a treat, okay? And kept saying, I want this, I want that, I want this, I want that, whatever. And finally the parents said, all right, I'll give it to you after you finish your lunch, right? So lunch was over, and the kid was playing, and the kid went off to play. And then, you know, lunch was over, and we were done, and the guests were leaving, and I heard the parents saying to the kid, no, I'm sorry, I don't have any. I said, wow. Like, if you don't have any, and you tell your child, I'm going to give you one, then what have you just done? You just lied to your child. And you taught your child it's okay to lie. It seems like such an insignificant thing. But if I would have asked this parent, and I didn't do it, I didn't think it was my place, but if I would have asked this parent, right, how would you feel if I told you that you're teaching your child to lie? So obviously the parent would be shocked how easy it is for us to do this, right? I remember once we were sitting, and someone said to a child of theirs, when the phone rang, listen, pick it up, unless it's grandma, tell them I'm not home. What do you mean? Tell them my parent can't come to the phone. Tell them we'll call you back as soon as we can. How easy it is to teach your children to lie. So easy, right? How often do you tell people something when you don't really mean it? It's a form of lying. I mean, I'll give you an example. So I always tell students, people I meet, whatever, you know, that I'm having a discussion, I don't have a chance to talk to you during the day, so call me. Call me at home, whatever. What if I know I'm not going to be there? What if I know I'm not going to be there? Isn't it easy to tell someone, someone's nudging you at a wedding, right? Isn't it easy to say, you know what, call me home tonight. I know I'm not going to be there. Don't I have an obligation to tell that person, listen, call me tonight, I'm not going to be there. But leave a message and that will remind me, and I'll try to get back to you. And if you don't have a phone, so that'll just remind me or call me at a certain time and I'll try to be there. And it's such an insignificant thing, but it's a lie. How easy it is to lie and how easy it is to teach others to lie. Second point, very interesting. Can you ever really only commit one inviolate act? Think about it. Can you ever be only lying? Can you ever be only stealing? Or won't theft always lead to lying, and won't lying always lead to some form of theft? Beautiful idea. Tradition tells us, mitzvah goreret mitzvah, avera goreret avera. One, we'll call it a sin. We've already discussed that that's not an accurate translation. But one sin leads to another, and one mitzvah, one good act, leads to another. Fascinating idea. If I lie, it becomes very easy to lie again. If I steal, I'm almost forced to lie. I'll give you an example. One of the symbols of lying and theft in the Bible is false weights, false measurements. If you're a merchant, you're not allowed to have false weights. Matter of fact, there are all sorts of halakhic questions that are asked. You know, they have these things that are like a tray, and you put your vegetables in them, and they weigh the vegetables. So you can't really ever get something to be exactly accurate. Only God can be accurate, right? So isn't that a form of lying? So the rabbis actually suggest that you should always fix them in such a way, or fix the price in such a way, so that the inaccuracy is in the favor of the client. That's an assumption. In other words, If tomatoes are 10 shekels a kilo, so I should always set it so that I'm setting 10 shekels for a kilo and a half a gram. So that if it's not exact, it won't be exact in my loss. But now that raises an interesting question. So the client comes, and he's stealing from the merchant. So no, he's not stealing because the merchant gives it him as a present. So look at that. But now it's very interesting, because this is used as theft. But can you have false weights without lying? Can you steal without lying? Can't do it. One inevitably involves the other. And yet the Torah only uses this to define the issue of theft. Part of the problem of a path is that you can't just take one step down a path and stay there. You will inevitably continue walking on that path. And so that's also part of the concept of lying. Can you train yourself, right, to become honest? And I'll give you one last example of falsehood, which is magnificent, and then we'll see if we can put into practice, just for 2 minutes, practical application. Tremendous idea. This is in Deuteronomy in chapter 13, verse 4. And look it up if you get a chance. It's a magnificent section. If somebody comes, ki yakum bekir b'chan navi, if a prophet arises amongst you, o cholem halom, a dreamer of dreams, and he comes and he says to you, right, and this is describing something called a false prophet. And he says to you, Baha otam ofek, right? There will be some kind of a sign. I don't know. The sun is going to stand still tomorrow. And indeed, the sun stands still tomorrow. So he's a nami. And then he says, Lemur, this sign shows that I'm a prophet, saying, Telchu acharei Elohim acharim asher lo yada'atem, you should now follow other gods that you didn't know. I, as a prophet, tell you that this means that you should worship idolatry. Right? Lo tishma'al anavi yahu. You're not supposed to listen to that prophet because he's called a navi sheker, a false prophet, a prophet of lies. And it's interesting, by the way, that the issue is not whether this miracle came to be. That has nothing to do with it. And the Bible says that, in fact, he could predict something and it could really be a miracle. And God is somehow testing you. God is testing you. For example, the issue when it comes to Christianity is not whether Jesus was born of a virgin birth. That doesn't matter to me. Whether it could be or it couldn't be, what the Talmud says is irrelevant. Because that's not the issue. The issue is what I'm supposed to gain from that. Right? Did Moses talk to a burning bush? I mean, that's not the issue. The issue is, okay, so what am I learning? So, a prophet can prophesy falsely. And it's interesting, he's still called a prophet, even when he's a false prophet. When you begin to think about it, isn't any falsehood a false prophecy? Isn't it indeed a false testimony? Who am I? And how do I relate to you? I testify to you as to who I am. And everything that I do, and everything that I say, is a testimony to me. And if my testimony is false, then your perception of me is false. And in a certain way, I am false. How far does that go? Tremendous idea. Can I present myself as something that I'm not? If I'm giving you a false image. Can I say things that present myself in a different light, that give you a different image? So the underlying theme of falsehood is, again, testimony with regards to who I am. And if testimony is all about human relationships and the harmony that can exist between people, then falsehood is really about the creation of a false testimony and an inaccurate harmony that can exist between people. And that leads me to the next point, which is, when is it permissible? And it's interesting that there's an underlying theme. First of all, we assume that falsehood is objectively wrong. And by virtue of the fact that I say that falsehood is not objectively wrong, but in fact is sometimes permissible, this tells me that there's a higher ideal. And it goes without saying that, as we've mentioned before, that Judaism has to be based on this question. So everything in terms of how you relate to lying is very much a function of what the nature, what the authority of that prohibition is. If there is some sort of a divine form of lying, then you don't have to say that lying is objectively wrong. It's only objectively wrong if that objective authority says it's wrong. So now look at some examples of when falsehood is permitted. Making peace between two people. Well, that makes sense. If the whole problem with falsehood is that I'm presenting a false testimony, that I'm somehow undermining the harmony that exists between people, then it goes without saying that to bring peace to two people, I'm allowed to do that. Now, that's a very dangerous thing. Because how far do I go? And the rabbis discuss the fact that you can only do this if there is no other option. And I want you to know, personally, it's very rare to find that there's no other option to bring peace between two people. But if there really is no other option, and even if there is no other option, and you do have to lie, you're still supposed to couch your language in terms that closely resemble the truth. For example, Jacob. When Jacob, in Genesis chapter 27, verse 19, is speaking to his father Isaac in the process of stealing the birthright, because stealing and lying are always related, and he somehow is painted by the Bible, this is a longer story, and also in the next course of ethics, right? But he somehow has the right to do this, somehow. So he comes before Isaac, and Isaac says, who are you? because he's been dressed up by his mother to pretend to be Esav. And he's got woolen, you know, sleeves so that he'll feel like Esav, like hairy Esav. So he says, "Ani Esav b'chorecha. I am Esav, your firstborn." He's not. He's lying. So Rashi, super commentary on the Bible, says a tremendous thing. He says, Yaakov was so uncomfortable with the act of lying that he puts a comma there. Ani, I'm me. Esav b'chorecha. Esav is your firstborn. Come on. I mean, he's lying. Perhaps what Rashi is really saying there is, of course he's lying. But it should bother you, even when you are allowed to lie, to have to lie. Tremendous idea. Because every time you lie, even if you lie permissibly, it becomes easier to lie. And that should bother you. If you have a great time at somebody else's house, I don't know, you go to Efrat the Shabbat, hopefully you have a wonderful time, and then someone else asks you about it, are you allowed to tell them you had a great time? If you say you had a great time, maybe they'll call this person and they'll say, we want to come to Shabbat. What if you're having a discussion with someone you suspect is an unscrupulous person? And you think they're going to take advantage of this host. Says the Talmud, you're allowed to lie. And say, well, you know, whatever. Because you don't want to put them in an uncomfortable situation. Right? You're allowed to lie out of humility. Somebody comes over to you and says, well, you know, do you feel that you know the works of Plato? And let's say you studied the works of Plato. So it's permissible for you to say, well, you know, I read them a little. I can't say I know them well, whatever. Even if you think you do know them well. Right? Out of humility. Because again, if the whole problem of lying is what it does to you as a person, how it affects your relationship with other human beings. So in this particular instance, it affects your relationship with other human beings and affects you as a person if you have pride. So, okay. It's permitted, this is really interesting, it's permitted to deceive someone who's trying to deceive you to save yourself from being cheated. Very interesting halacha. Right? If someone's trying to deceive you and you realize it, and the only way you can avoid being cheated is if you deceive them, sometimes you're allowed to do that. Very interesting question. Right? It's permitted to praise something that somebody bought. Or to praise a bride, halachically. Right? It's permitted to save a life, obviously, to lie. Right? This one I love. The Rambam in the Laws of Talmud Torah says that it's permitted for a teacher, right, to lie in order to be sure that his students are alert. Right? And if you're sitting with fourth graders, you want to see if they're listening to you, say, you know, and Avram, the son of Yitzchak, right? That's a lie. And essentially, and this is the answer to one of my original questions, right? You're permitted to make a statement which is an obvious exaggeration that everyone is aware of, such as I've told you 1,000 times, because it's not a lie. Because everybody's aware of it. It doesn't affect their perception of you. It's not a false testimony. It's not whatever it might be. Now that I have a picture, and obviously it goes without saying, nobody should listen to this class and come away with any sort of a halachic ruling. You know, when it comes to the laws of Shabbat, if I want to know how to cook a chicken on Shabbat, so even though those laws are very complex, I could theoretically come away feeling like I understand more or less how to do something. When it comes to laws on lying and cheating and honesty and things like that, these are very complex laws. And if you're ever unsure, so it's worthwhile. Okay. But how, right? How do you deal with this? How do you avoid lying? So I'll tell you 3 things that I saw. One, this was mind-boggling to me, right? The Sefer Chassidim says an unbelievable thing. It says that even your facial expressions should be true. Unbelievable. In other words, if I'm not interested in something, I shouldn't pretend to be interested in something. Now, when is that not true? If one of the original statements that I just made a moment ago, harmony, promote peace, whatever it might be. So, again, you walk out of this room and you think like, this is ridiculous. It's too much. You know, I don't want to lie. Okay, give me a break. But if your thought process becomes involved in these questions, so there's a very fine line between fanaticism and beauty. And every one of us has to find that line. But the very fact that your thought process is activated on such remote concepts makes it more difficult for you to lie. And so I would tell you the same thing as I told you yesterday, right? I saw a beautiful idea of Mordechai Chernobyl, quoted in his name in Rizal Kristin's book. He says that if you do lie, you should make a habit of saying, you know what, that's not true. Or, I've just told you a lie. Because if you make it easy for yourself to say, I just lied, or something isn't true, then it will become easier for you to avoid lying in the future. Right? That's first of all. Second, you should once again, can we consider the implications of a given lie and the value of that lie? Okay? And third, is it ever worth ultimately the price that you pay?
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.